name is Rebecca Lehman. I am the Associates Program Director at ELI. Welcome to our second to last session of Summer School, the Law and Policy of Products Regulation. This is a series we have every summer, co-sponsored by the DC Bar's Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources section. We have one of our favorite faculty today, Lynn L. Bergeson, with Bergeson and Campbell. She is also a teacher at our boot camp, and so we're lucky to have her not once, but twice a year, or more. So without further ado, I will turn this over to you, Lynn.
Thank you very much, Rebecca, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and for those of you on the phone, it is truly a pleasure to be here. I very much look forward to the summer sessions because they tend to be a little more relaxed and open-ended, and I'm hoping that both folks on the phone and those of you here in our audience feel perfectly free to say, whoa, what did you just say, or raise questions, or because the goal of this program up until maybe 1:45, or we can have questions throughout, it doesn't really matter, is to enable you to get a pretty good understanding of TSCA and FIFRA, two federal statutes that are included within the panoply of federal environmental statutes, but often they're thought to be kind of a little on the oddball side, because a lot of you guys will be environmental practitioners and perhaps not have occasion to wander into the wonderful world of pesticides or chemical substances. But before we talk about the substance and go to the PowerPoint presentation, Rebecca has asked me to give a little background on what I do and how it is I came to own both a law firm and three consulting firms, because that's the confederation of what we do. And for those of you that are business-minded, I often mentor younger people like yourself on what are some of the business opportunities in the practice of law, because the practice of law is an exceedingly dynamic area. And gone is the day when you can just hitch your wagon to a big law firm or even government and hope that you'll be there 30 years later. You need to be nimble, you need to follow the action, you need to be aware of where the work is. But most importantly, park yourself in an area that makes you happy, that is intellectually stimulating, and fulfills what it is you wish to do with your life as a professional, a lawyer or otherwise, because there may well be some non-lawyer professionals in here. In that regard, half of our staff are non-lawyer professionals, PhDs, organic chemists, epidemiologists, risk assessors, people that are very much a part of the problem-solving equation when it comes to environmental law, policy, and regulation. So it does take a village, to coin a popular phrase by a fabulous woman, and many non-lawyers populate our staff. But once upon a time, I graduated from law school. I worked for a relatively large law firm. An assistant administrator for AIR had just rotated out of EPA and needed some help in dealing with both the AIR program and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act RCRA program. And for reasons that I probably should never admit to, they both interested me because they are more code-oriented. RCRA, as you know, do I need to do something?
Okay.
RCRA is largely a statute dealing with hazardous and solid waste, but the implementing regulations are set out in a long series of 40 CFR sections. And I just like the order, the symmetry, and the fact that there was a pretty clear sense of what a regulated entity needed to do. And it was a brand new statute with new implementing regulations, and the newness of it all was exciting. So one thing led to another. A couple of firms later, partners split, as law firms often do, and I found myself in a position of just taking my business and carrying on with my business partner, Lisa Campbell. We've been now a totally woman-owned law firm in Washington, D.C. for over 25 years. We have our core office in Washington, and about 10 years ago created a consulting affiliate here in Washington and one in the U.K. to become active in the European chemical market. As many of you know, the European law of industrial chemicals changed dramatically back in 2007, 2008 under REACH, and we wanted to be a participant in that market. And again, being business-minded, you have to offer services that your clients need, and we have positioned ourselves to be a provider of chemical registration, support, and management, not just in the United States under TSCA and FIFRA, but around the world. We do a lot of work in the European Union under REACH. We do a lot of work under a growing number of chemical notification laws in Turkey, China, Korea, Taiwan, Australia, and elsewhere. And so creating a business platform that enables you to offer services to international chemical manufacturers in the industrial and agrochemical and antimicrobial markets has been both challenging and fun. And you get to meet a lot of people and patch together a business platform that it's fun. So for those of you that like both practicing law and building a business, there are so many opportunities in this area of product regulation. There are many other opportunities in a lot of areas, climate change, water, which, you know, we all know that water is one of the rarest and most precious natural resources on the face of the earth, and preserving it and protecting it and maximizing it is increasingly a matter that is challenging lawyers and policymakers alike. So you've probably already done water. What's your last program?
Careers next week.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to come back and talk about careers, too. But, you know, there's no rhyme nor reason on how people find what it is that makes them happy and professionally, fulfilled. But my story is no more complicated than that. I love working in chemicals, and the areas that are emerging, nanotechnology, biotechnology, all of the omics, toxicogenomics, the intersection of law, policy, and regulation, there's no better place than Washington, D.C., because that's where the action is. That's another important point, and then I'm going to stop talking about career development. But TSCA and FIFRA are two federal statutes that are not delegated to states. All of the action, all of the laws, and all of the federal implementation work is here in Washington. And once I left the great state of Michigan, I didn't want to go back because I don't like winters, wanted to stay here, and just looking down the road back in the mid-80s, it became crystal clear that air, water, waste are all delegated. So if you're trying to build a practice here, you need to focus on statutes and implementing programs that don't allow regional or large offices or small local offices to do the work more efficiently and better because of closer relationships with the regulatory community. So TSCA and FIFRA are federal laws that all of it happens here. And we'll talk a little bit maybe in our discussion later on how, because of some inherent failings with our federal industrial chemical law, states have been much more proactive, energetic, innovative, and imaginative in developing their own state laws, many of which are kind of one-off. They might be one chemical specific, and they might be specific to a particular application of a chemical. And that has tended to erode the integrity of the system that has the federal government being the primary law of the land, as it were, with respect to industrial chemicals and agrochemicals, but certainly less so in the FIFRA area, but definitely in the TSCA area, as our colleague from Senator Lautenberger's staff would be the first to admit. There are some serious issues with TSCA that need to be addressed, and they need to be addressed soon. But we'll get to that. So any questions on that little frolic and detour on career building and how it is that I'm still doing this stuff in Washington in a boutique law firm that has been very successful, but it's also been just a whole lot of fun? Well, then why don't we turn immediately to what we are here to talk about, and that is we're going to talk about chemical product laws, but I'd like to put it in the context of the whole panoply of federal environmental laws generally. We're going to talk specifically about TSCA, which is the regulation of industrial chemicals, and also talk specifically about pesticides, which are regulated under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, FIFRA. Don't say FUFRA or words to that effect, because it will display a certain ignorance regarding the pesticide law. But FIFRA is a fascinating statute that I think those of you that like policy work, this is an excellent opportunity to focus on this stuff. Both of these laws rely upon a risk-benefit analysis, which a lot of other statutes don't. So in order for the federal government to undertake certain actions, it has to show that the benefit of that action is trumps whatever risk there might be in doing otherwise. And we're going to talk more about that. But where do these kind of fall into the grand scheme of things? When I went to law school a billion and a half years ago, we didn't have defined environmental curricula. We talked about federal environmental laws, but only in the context of kind of air, water, waste, or water, rock, waste type big stuff. And we divided the statutes according to whether they were chemical byproduct laws, laws like the Clean Air Act that tries to address fugitive and point source emissions from manufacturing facilities, and other types of facilities that are subject to the jurisdictional limits of the Clean Air Act. More recently, obviously, greenhouse gas and other more niche areas like fuel additives under the Clean Air Act Section 211 program have been more robust in years past. Restrictions on ozone depleting substances. These are all somewhat chemical specific, but largely deal with byproducts of manufacturing operations or other types of mobile source emissions. The Clean Water Act, again, emissions, both point and non-point source emissions from manufacturing facilities to waterways throughout the United States, and also to publicly owned treatment works through indirect point sources under the pretreatment program. Safe Drinking Water Act, again, these are all dealing with contaminants of one form or another in various environmental media. The Chemical Waste and Disposal Laws, Resource Conservation Recovery Act, dealing with both hazardous waste as defined under RCRA Subtitle C and Subtitle D, solid waste. And CERCLA, the cleanup of past indiscretions, indiscretions and contaminations that happened likely years ago. CERCLA is a very mature law. It was coming into its own when I started my career. I got as far away from CERCLA as I possibly could because the thought of duking it out with 200 of my closest lawyer friends over the allocation of waste and cost for cleanup was about as appealing as getting a root canal. So I never did CERCLA and never regretted it. Workplace laws, it's another important area of the mix with respect to exposure of targeted populations to contaminants in the work environment. Obviously, it's not even regulated by EPA, kind of. We'll talk a little bit about that. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration under the Department of Labor deals with permissible exposure limits, workplace protection standards, health and safety. But interestingly, EPA, under the TSCA program, does have the authority to manage worker exposure to new chemicals under a variety of mechanisms under the Toxic Substances Control Act. So the interface between DOL OSHA authority and EPA authority to limit exposures to toxic substances under TSCA see an intersection at that point. There are a bunch of chemical transportation laws that happily we're not going to talk about, not part of the curriculum here, but very important when it comes to managing releases and transporting materials in commerce in ways that are both safe and transparent to those that are offloading materials through labeling and other transportation restrictions. And there are just a ton of other laws that similarly affect chemicals. The Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act and the Consumer Product Safety Act, the Federal Hazardous Substance Act, and Hazardous Substances and Household Products, these are all part of a larger gamish of federal authorities that regulate substances in one form or another. So, and Homeland Security, not part of the program, but ever since 9/11, we've had a whole uptick of activities relating to the regulation of hazardous substances and substances that might be considered dangerous through the Homeland Security Appropriations Act, Chemical Facility Anti-Terrorism Standards, the CFAT standards. All of these relate to the management and regulation of chemical substances, but they come into it at very various parts of either the manufacturing process, the transport process, or even the management and regulation of chemicals for purposes of domestic homeland security so they don't pose terrorist risk. We're going to focus on just right now the Toxic Substances Control Act. It is the kind of core federal statute that regulates materials, chemical substances, whether they are imported into the United States or whether they are manufactured here. And there are other opportunities for the regulation of that same substance, but TSCA is really the core federal statute that we're going to spend a bunch of time talking about. And it is the substance, the neat substance, trichloroethylene or chromium, or the neat substance as a manufactured industrial chemical. That's what TSCA does. It was first signed into law back in 1976, which is light years ago in terms of federal lawmaking, and yet as many both TSCA supporters and detractors will tell you, it hasn't really been substantively amended in all those years, which is astonishing given the revolution going on in the manufacture of chemical substances at the nanoscale and everything that we now know about chemical substances. That this law has not been substantively amended in that period of time is both a reflection, as I'm quick to point out, of the elegance of the original statute, but it's also a reflection of the fact that we are not keeping pace with as much as we know about chemical substances now by not having the law amended. My view, my personal parochial view. TSCA regulates chemical substances. Now, what does that not include? Well, it excludes chemicals that are regulated pretty exhaustively under other federal programs, like pesticides. That's the fifth part of the equation, which we'll talk about. Food additives, drugs. These are regulated under various centers of the Food and Drug Administration. Cosmetics and devices. These are all defined terms of art. So the important thing to remember, for those of you that may never, you know, deal with TSCA again, is that it pretty much deals with all industrial chemicals that are not otherwise regulated under FDA centers or is considered a pesticide. And I put in mixtures there because sometimes when I talk about, well, what do you mean TSCA doesn't cover mixtures? Does that mean you can have five different chemical substances, throw it in a pitcher, jigger it up, and that mixture is excluded from regulation? What it means is that each of the chemical components in the mixture must separately be subject to TSCA and is separately subject to TSCA. But the gamish is not, as a separate regulated entity, as it were, under TSCA. Okay? And then there are a lot of chemicals that might have more than one use. If you look at a pharmaceutical product, for example, that, because it's a pharmaceutical, is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, but when you look at the ingredients, you'll see a lot of the ingredients might also be regulated under other federal statutes. Phenol, for example, P-H-E-N-O-L, is both an active ingredient in chloraseptic, you squirt in your throat, but phenol is often used in industrial settings for a whole host of purposes. So you need to focus when you're problem-solving for a client or for your boss, that a chemical can be regulated under multiple statutes. It depends upon the use to which the chemical is being put. If it's a pesticide application, that chemical can be regulated under pesticide law. If it's an industrial chemical, it can be regulated under TSCA. If it's a chemical that is subject to FDA jurisdiction because it has a medicinal or pharmaceutical use, it's going to be subject to FDA. So that's what dual or tri-use chemicals are. Talked a little bit about mixtures. It's any combination of two or more chemical substances if the combination does not occur in nature. So if you're adding two things together, that's a mixture. The mixture itself is not subject to TSCA, but the two individual chemical substances that are part of the mixture, or three or four or five, those are subject to TSCA. So far, so good? Okay, well, how do you know if you're subject to TSCA? Say you are starting out in the business world. Is everybody having to do with chemical acquisition and processing and use subject to TSCA? Well, certainly if you're manufacturing chemical substances, you are subject to TSCA. And the law takes the position that if you are manufacturing chemicals in Asia or offshore anywhere, including Canada and Mexico, and importing them into the United States, as soon as they hit the territorial boundaries of the United States, you are a manufacturer. So your status shifts from that of an importer to a manufacturer. So just every time manufacturing is mentioned in the statute or the regs, an importer is included within that universe of entities. And for many years, when I was, and I do represent clients, but the thought was if you're a manufacturer and importer, you really need to focus on TSCA. And if you're anybody else, a processor or a formulator or a distributor, not to worry, because most of the burdens under TSCA fall on the community that manufactures these chemicals. That's changing to a very large extent. And under the EPA's implementation of TSCA, EPA is far more interested now not just in who's making chemicals, but where are they going. If you make a chemical and then another entity purchases the chemical and formulates it, and another chemical company takes that formulation and does some more stuff to it, and then somebody purchases that chemical and formulates it into a consumer product and then distributes it to a distributor, and then it's sold to a retailer, and a retailer then markets it to a consumer. That whole value chain is much more the subject of EPA review now with respect to where the chemical is going and what are the opportunities for exposure to a particular chemical throughout that entire value chain. But that's a relatively recent origin. So historically, manufacturing importers, that's where the action was under TSCA. Processors, a couple of the provisions under TSCA also include processors, but by and large, many of the provisions we're going to talk today relate to manufacturers and importers. So in terms of a client base, they're the large, medium, and small chemical producers and importers that are most impacted by what we're going to talk about. Now, there's a very important component of TSCA called the TSCA inventory, and I'm going to explain why that's really important and why it's both an intellectually and practically challenging concept. But the inventory is just what you might imagine. It is a very long list of chemicals identified by either chemical abstract number, which is a particular set of numbers assigned to a chemical. I think most of you know what a CAS number is. It's an identifier. And how did the chemical inventory come to be? Well, the law was passed in 76. By 79, EPA went out and said, look, tell us what chemicals are in commerce right now under the terms of the rule that went out under the TSCA inventory implementation provisions. And chemical manufacturers and importers wrote back to EPA, and the process of writing back to EPA put that chemical on the inventory that is maintained under Section 8 of TSCA. Now, does that mean that EPA reviewed and assessed the risks, the chemical potencies, and chemical profile of each of those 80 to 90,000 chemicals that came back on the list? No. It means that those chemicals were deemed existing chemicals for purposes of the TSCA program and were more or less grandfathered into the program. And EPA did not do a de novo review of the chemical with a view toward assessing whether it might pose biological or environmental risks under certain circumstances. So you got a great big list called an inventory that now has, I think, upwards of 85,000 chemicals or so, thereabouts, give or take a few thousand. What does that mean? Does that mean each and every one of those chemicals is now in commerce and might be a chemical that is actually used? No, not by a long shot. In fact, when you're in this area, as long as I have been, you know that a lot of chemicals are on the inventory that really might have had very little use and application at all, or were more robust but have subsequently come off the list because they've fallen into disuse. So people have tried to take a shot at identifying what number might be a more credible, more realistic number, and it might be in the 45 to 50,000, but the number of chemicals on the inventory is probably not terribly realistic.
So grandfather chemicals were those that were first reported and subsequently added to the inventory through a review process that EPA now has been developing over the last 30 years, which we'll talk about. But if you have an existing chemical, that's a chemical that's in use and on the inventory. And if it's not on the inventory, it is per se new. And it ceases being new once it gets on the inventory and becomes existing. So any new chemical developed after 1979, subject to the new chemical review process, gets on the inventory, so new becomes existing. Pretty simple stuff. Now, the new chemical review program under Section 5, very important part of the TSCA program. I, having worked with the scientists and EPA folks for many years, have great respect for EPA. I think they do a really good job of taking a new chemical or a chemical that has been submitted to the agency for review, because you can't lawfully import or manufacture a chemical except under certain very limited circumstances without, and then wish to sell that or market that chemical without EPA signing off on it. Okay, that's kind of the essence of the TSCA program. If a new chemical or a chemical formula species is manufactured and you believe it's got great commercial potential, has lots of applications, you just can't, okay, I'm going to mix this up and sell it. You have to have it approved by EPA. I use that term loosely because EPA doesn't really approve it per se, but there's a pre-market review process that is anticipated under TSCA Section 5. And that authorizes EPA to review activities associated with the manufacture, processing, use, and disposal of new chemicals before they enter the marketplace. And I think by and large, EPA has gotten pretty high marks for the quality of its review process. At least I think they do a pretty good job. EPA has a lot of authority under the review process, and the agency has over the years really perfected the methodologies and the risk protocols that it has used over the years to ensure that if a chemical is new and heretofore has not had any commercial presence, it has a lot of really good tools and methodologies to assess whether that chemical, when used as represented in an application called a pre-manufactured notice submission, is going to pose the type of risk that the agency is here to prevent. So that's what the new chemical review process does, and the various opportunities to either have a diminished review or accelerated view go to whether or not you're dealing with small quantities or you're dealing with chemicals that are of a low volume and a low release potential. Bottom line is there are a lot of different exemptions from the full PMN review process that enable either small quantities or chemicals that are uniquely focused on very low releases to avoid a more robust review. The full review is to take 90 days under the statute. So you submit a pre-manufactured notification, pop it into the agency, 90 days later, if you don't hear from EPA and the agency hasn't affirmatively reached out to the submitter that for one reason or another the chemical shouldn't go forward in the review process, you can presume that the agency has completed its review and has not prevented its commercialization, and you can go forward and market. That process is, as I indicated, done through the mechanism of a pre-manufacture notification. And under the way the program works, and it's very intuitive and logical to me, is the agency has an opportunity to step back and say, wait a minute, what type of chemical is this? What class of chemicals does it fall into? What are the expected volumes that you're going to be manufacturing? Where might it be going? What are the exposure opportunities to workers, to others who might be more vulnerable and amenable to releases? What is the toxicity of the chemical? Might it pose adverse health effects, and at what doses and at what levels? So this PMN review process is the opportunity for EPA to parachute in and take a look at the chemical and assess whether it poses risks that the statute is here to prevent. And the agency has an awful lot of authority under the PMN review process to say, we're not comfortable and we're going to want to see a lot more data, in which case you can withdraw the PMN application if you are not inclined to want to generate those data.
You can agree to do the data under a schedule that the agency negotiates with the submitter. The agency can say, based on our review of the chemical, we think it's fine, but we're a little concerned about releases to water, so you can manufacture the chemical, but we're not going to allow you to make any discharge, so you have to containerize the material. So there are an awful lot of opportunities for EPA to restrict exposure to new chemicals through the tools it has under the TSCA program. Lynn?
Yes, briefly, and just process-wise, how does this compare to what the FDA does with the pharmaceutical company? Is it shorter or longer or more detailed or require sort of the same types of exposure on a test, that type of thing?
Lynn has asked, how does the PMN review process under TSCA Section 5 compare with, say, a new pharmaceutical review process under the FDA Act? And I think they're probably quite different, the latter being more labor-intensive, data-intensive. And, again, one of the concerns that have been expressed many times over TSCA is that TSCA Section 5 does not compel a whole battery of tests with respect to the potency, toxicological, ecological, environmental consequences of the chemical in the environment, that you are required to submit information that you have associated with a new chemical, or if you are developing data, you are required to report that in your application. But one of the provisions in virtually all of the Senate and House measures that are seeking to amend TSCA substantively would compel the submission of a minimum data set to supplement what we know about a new chemical that is going through the review process. Not just for new chemicals, but we might need a minimum data set with regard to existing chemicals. Just a minimum evaluation of, are there developmental issues, neurotox issues, what about EFATE, what about? So a minimum data set or an MDS provision is what is now being looked at pretty hard in pending TSCA reform legislation, but that is not a part of the existing law, and that the agency relies to a very great extent on various protocols and models to assess the toxicological and biological potency of a new chemical. And I know reasonable people will disagree, and our colleague from Senator Lautenberger's staff may or may not agree with this proposition, but many of us that have been working in the TSCA area for decades give EPA a lot of kudos for having very mature, good models that can assess the biological and environmental potency of a chemical, even if the actual data don't exist. Would real data be better? Well, yeah, because sometimes modeled data can be more aggressive and inspire greater commercial restrictions on a chemical than the actual data might. But when you submit a chemical to the agency, and if you don't have a lot of data, the agency will take the fundamental molecular structure of the material and put it through a number of risk models, and what comes out at the end is what you got to live with. And to me, it's like you pick your poison. You do the data and understand what you're dealing with, or you run it through the traps that the agency has in the new chemicals division, and you are wedded to those results. And it's those results that dictate whether or not your new chemical has no commercial restriction because it's mother's milk and benign under all circumstances. Not a lot of those. For you know, good reason. Or there's toxicological or environmental baggage associated with your chemical that you need to do workarounds. You either need to diminish exposures in the workplace to ensure workers are not adversely impacted. You need to manufacture it differently and make sure there's no release into waterways. You need to make sure that the ambient work environment isn't peppered with exposures that might give rise to half face or full face or supplied air respiratory protection, which, again, if you start backing these requirements up, it starts to become commercially distasteful to start manufacturing chemicals that require all of these restrictions of no release, no discharge, no ambient exposures into the workplace. And so after a while, you're kind of either going to do the data or live with the results. And if you live with the results, you need to factor that into your commercial projection of the utility of that chemical and whether or not it's going to be commercially viable, or if it has so many bells and whistles associated with it that downstream customers might be disinclined to use your chemical over something that is inherently less toxic or less aggressive in various environments. And today, there is a huge incentive to be moving in a direction of chemical substitutes and materials that are inherently less toxic, so you can avoid the types of commercial restrictions that the provisions of TSCA and any forthcoming TSCA reform almost certainly will inspire. So you've got, for the, you business people out there, or those of you that are interested in the policy side here, recognize that the yin and the yang of federal law is part of what EPA wishes to do, and what many in Congress are trying to do is incentivize the identification and development of inherently greener molecules to ensure that downstream customers and others don't have to deal with the legacy that we are now dealing with in other chemical contexts. Now, you've submitted your PMN, you got a brand new chemical, and it is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and you're going to make a screen $1 billion because it does everything, including your windows and laundry. EPA has found it relatively benign and has associated no restrictions on it. On the 90th day after you've submitted the PMN application, and again, the PMN application is not a three-page piece of paper. It is a mature, challenging, and very important document that you need to get right. And in our shop, for example, and at Beveridge and Diamond and Arnold and Porter and many other law firms in Washington and elsewhere, you have non-lawyer and lawyer professionals ensure that you are meeting both the spirit, the letter, and the scientific bona fides of the application. Because if you screw up, you have to go back at the end of the line, and a 6-month, 12-month delay in the commercialization of a product line can cost millions, if not billions, of dollars. So you need to get it right. So you submit the application, smooth sailing, you never hear from EPA. On the 91st day, you're the junior associate on the team at Beveridge and Diamond. What do you tell Mark Duvall? Go for it. You didn't hear from EPA, that means life is wonderful. What we do, as I'm sure Mark does, is call EPA to make sure that that phone call that was supposed to be made but forgot to get made, and it really did get snared up in the process and it didn't drop out of the program, you want to be careful and proactive. So call your friendly EPA team manager and say, you know, it's the 91st day, are we good to go? And he or she will say, yes, you are, you're good to go. And that, can you then immediately start the commercial manufacture of your chemical? No. You got to get that chemical on that TSCA inventory that we talked about. And that is done through the mechanism of a notice of commencement of commercial manufacture import. So the NOC, the submission of that notice, is what actually gets your chemical on the inventory. Okay? And you, what's the significance of having a chemical on the inventory? If a chemical is not on the inventory, there are two inventories I neglected to add. Was a super secret private one called the confidential inventory that EPA would tell you, but it would have to kill you. And then there's the public inventory, which is a publicly accessible database. So you're asked, either in your office, your boss says, hey, I've got hexylmethyl super dust. Is it on the inventory? So you go and you check it's on the inventory and you see, lo and behold, it's not on the inventory. What do you do then? It could be on the super secret inventory. So can you just call up EPA and say, I've got hexylmethyl super pixie dust here. Is it on the inventory? The answer is no, it's not that easy. You have to submit what is called a bona fide submission, which expresses your bona fide intent to import or manufacture this chemical. And you have to submit this application, which is pretty robust. It's not just here's the chemical and here's the formula. Is it on the inventory? It's pretty robust. But you submit that, and if the agency determines that it's on the super secret inventory, it will tell you. But that submission is what prompts the response. So if it's on the confidential inventory, you don't have to submit anything further, and you're good to go. If it's not on the confidential inventory and it's not on the public inventory, you have to submit a PMN. And if you don't submit a PMN, these are some of the eye-popping, super heroic penalties that we have seen over the many years that EPA has been enforcing TSCA, the multi-million dollar, you've been manufacturing or importing a chemical that is new and not on the inventory, giving rise to all kinds of penalties, because EPA looks very dimly at exactly that fact pattern. Yes? The rationale is that the development, the innovation that goes into a brand new molecule is often supported by millions and millions and millions of dollars. And so the agency is well aware, TSCA is well aware, Congress is well aware of the need to protect confidential business information, information that is proprietary to the innovator of that molecule. Lots of debate over how much protection, how long, and under what circumstances. And there are limitations, and in fact, the universe of confidential business information, or CBI, is much more diminished now than it was in years past. So the big picture rationale is that innovation is entitled to protection as a reward for your financial investment. And there are all kinds of other, you know, international piracy issues and gee, how can our federal system protect information that really should be held secret because of the confidential nature and the proprietary nature of the molecule? Information that others really don't need to know because EPA knows that information and it just is not authorized to release it. And EPA does a fabulous job of keeping information confidential. Very infrequently do train wrecks happen. But that's the rationale, that proprietary information should be protected and doesn't need to be released to people or entities that could misappropriate that very proprietary information and exploit it in a way that would disadvantage the owner of those data. But again, there is a huge debate, and I would be remiss to not note that there is a tension between right-to-know laws and proprietary business information that doesn't go to health and safety issues, but goes to the core molecular structure of a new molecule, which will remain confidential. Okay? Other questions on that one? Okay, so anyway, the big eye-popping penalties under TSCA are often in the Section 5 area of failure to submit a PMN and not on the inventory, and you've been manufacturing and using a chemical that nobody knows anything about, and that's going to get you in trouble. Okay? Talked about TSCA inventory already, the 85 to 90, not currently necessarily a reflection of what's in commerce, but it's still a very big number. Now let's talk a little bit about information collection activities, because this is another very, very interesting, it's a fascinating area of the law, and there are many provisions under the new pending TSCA reform measures that would really change a lot of this, but at its core here, we have TSCA Section 8, which allows EPA to collect production, use, and exposure information. And EPA does it through rulemaking. You look at the Federal Register. If it's a chemical that you're manufacturing, importing, you want to be mindful of this, and the agency can compel the submission of that information. TSCA Section 8 inventory update rule. This is where companies report on production, use, and exposure information on certain substances over a threshold of 25,000 pounds per chemical per facility. And right now there's a two-tier process that if you manufacture a chemical at a facility in quantities of 300,000 pounds a year, you have to submit a bunch more information. Now, why is this a big deal? This is a big deal because EPA has been trying for years to modify the elements under this Section 8A inventory update rule, or the IUR rule. And just this past, in the last several months, in May, EPA suspended the reporting requirement that otherwise would have been in effect June through September of this year, because significant revisions that it proposed last August, in August 2010, were held up at the Office of Management and Budget. So that rule was released by OMB on July the 8th. And it's now back at EPA. So for all the TSCA aficionados in Washington, we're all in a feeding frenzy over what the new law looks or the new rule looks like, because it will have a very significant impact on our domestic chemical community. And it will be much more robust in requiring the submission of information, not just with regard to the manufacturer and import of the chemical, but where is that chemical going in downstream use applications, and how many people are likely to be exposed to it. And it also diminishes some of the confidential business information provisions that heretofore have been applied. And it also requires electronic reporting. And if you're a Dow Chemical Company or a DuPont, electronic reporting is both efficient and attractive, but not the first go-around, because there are lots of hiccups in the system. So there are a lot of things coming out, and for those of you that are in a need to know, the rule should be published in the Federal Register this August, like next month, and the reporting time frame will probably be end of September through end of December for this reporting cycle. Section 8C, allegations. Companies have to retain allegations of adverse effects, and this is not just adverse effects allegations from your workers. You know, somebody on your manufacturing line comes to you and has a rash all over his or her arms. If the allegation goes to the likely exposure to the chemical that's being produced, you have an obligation to maintain that information in a file. And if EPA comes and inspects a facility and that file doesn't exist, you can be held responsible for a record-keeping violation under TSCA. I look at it more from a tort and product stewardship perspective. You don't want your workers developing adverse effects, so you don't maintain that information just because you must. Maintain that information because you don't want a chemical that you're manufacturing to give rise to adverse health effects. So this is a great way of tracking that and averting disasters from happening. 8D, health and safety studies. EPA can, in the Federal Register, say if you have health and safety studies that are not published, but you have them in your files, because a lot of chemical companies, as good product stewards, will test the chemicals that they manufacture under various scenarios. And when an 8D rule is published in the Federal Register, you have to compel, or EPA can compel the submission of that information. Now, why would EPA put in the Federal Register a rule saying, you know, we're sniffing around here, and we've got some issues with this chemical, and we want every bit of information in your files relating to it? Why do you think EPA would be doing that? Anybody? Probably because EPA has, through some source, information that leads the agency to believe that there's something it ought to be investigating. So when we see an 8D in the Federal Register, and we have clients that are manufacturing in that community, or downstream customers of product manufacturers that are purchasing the chemical for inclusion in their products, you look at this and you think, yikes, there must be something associated with this chemical, and you do a much more robust analysis to ensure that you're not looking at downstream liabilities, legacy liabilities, workplace problems, or tort liability, because we live, as you all know, in an exceedingly litigious society. So an 8D rule is a flag that you really need to prick up your ears and be aware that there might be something here or there might not be. But the agency doesn't go forward with an 8D rule if the concerns are not supported and trivial. And finally, 8E, risk reporting, is when companies must immediately, i.e. immediately, no more than 30 days, when a person that has reason to know that information regarding substantial risk of exposure to the chemical is new to them. So it's known to them. It doesn't need to be a final toxicological two-year bioassay or a fully developed developmental repro study. If you have new information that says there's something about this chemical that gives rise or could give rise to a substantial risk, you have an immediate obligation to report that under 8E. And EPA has used that reporting requirement very effectively in enforcement actions. Multi-million-dollar cases where if a chemical that you have is well studied, but you're now getting an effect at a different dose, or you're getting a different response at in a different species, a different line of animals. These are all new information, even if it's not quantified, and even if it's not fully understood what it all means. Our philosophy is you report that, and you report it in a way that will allow the agency to make reasonable inferences about what the chemical is. It's in your best interest, it's in your company's best interest, and certainly in the EPA's best interest. Yes. It could be. In 8C, if it's new, if you're getting some new adverse effect at a different exposure level, or, you know, that could be 8E-able. But 8C is, number one, you don't need to report it to EPA. You just need to keep a record of it in your files. And number two, it could be information that you know and EPA knows. I mean, we know that certain chemicals are caustic. Certain acids might cause, you know, have a corrosive effect. And if somebody is experiencing that adverse effect in the workplace under certain circumstances, it may or may not be give rise to an 8E. It's a new adverse effect, and believe me, ladies and gentlemen, there is a very well-developed body of law over what is reportable under 8E. When I was much younger, we used to hand-wring over whether something is reportable or not. And over the years, it's like, you know, if a bunch of smart people are sitting around fretting over whether it's reportable, it's probably reportable, so submit it. And why is there might be there concern about reporting it at all? What are the inferences that flow from a submission to EPA, which is searchable on an online public database? What are some of the reasons why you think an entity might be a little bit hesitant to submit an 8E report? Anybody?
Bad press.
Good response. Sometimes ADEs for chemicals that have a huge following in certain constituencies, exposure to infants and children, exposure to the elderly, or other compromised subpopulations. If it's a new adverse effect and it's in a very prevalent or a chemical that has a lot of potential exposures, it could give rise to adverse effect, which could have an adverse effect on a company's stock ranking, or it could give rise to tort liability or consumer concerns or an erosion of confidence in the product line. So you need to, I'm not being cavalier about this, any legal reporting obligation needs to go through a calculus and an analysis that is fully consistent with the law. But recognize, too, that it is not a reporting submission that without consequence. There are lots of chemical detractors that monitor the 8E submission docket and FOIA them and get them off the internet with an alarming regularity. So the submission of an 8E is an important submission, one that gives rise to lots of consequences. Okay, let's move this along here. It's 5 after 1. Okay, EPA gets a lot of information under all of these reporting provisions, but what if it's still lacking sufficient information, or the information that it has raises concerns about the underlying toxicological or environmental potency of a chemical substance? Well, what can EPA do? Well, it can issue a Section 4 rule compelling the submission of certain categories of information about the concern that the agency may have. It can be an endpoint specific. The agency in years past has taken, say, dozens of chemicals and say, as a class, we are concerned about the neurotoxic effects of these chemicals. So we want these batteries of tests done. We want them done this way, and we want them done by this date. And under TSCA, as under FIFRA, competitors are able to get together and jointly produce the data. Because the agency, the last thing EPA wants is a bunch of chemical producers manufacturing functionally the same fungible, neat product separately undergoing toxicological testing that might require the sacrifice of animals. So you can get together, you know, the 50 producers of ethylene glycol can get together and jointly generate the data that will respond to this TSCA Section 4 data requirement. That's the good news. Yes?
How easy is it for companies to do that?
In years, good question, because remember, you've got a room full of competitors here. And do you think they kind of come arm in arm and say, let's get this done, guys? Often they do, because historically, the domestic chemical community has been aware of the agency's need for information, and it's simply more efficient to divide a $2 million cancer bioassay 10 ways than doing it all yourself just because you don't want to have to deal with those knuckleheads. So the joint data production part has been relatively a pretty good success story. The wheels have run off the track, not so much with whether the testing is going to be done jointly. The wheels have run off the track with the inferences that flow from the suggestion by a federal government like EPA that we need these data in order to make informed judgments about the risk of this chemical. So those inferences are not commercially positive, and the pushback on Section 4 test rules, another very well-recognized concern with existing TSCA provisions, is the hoops that the agency must jump through in order to sustain this TSCA Section 4 test rule. They have historically been subject to a lot of litigation, and so much so that EPA now has opted for enforceable consent agreements that enable entities to generate data without going forward with the TSCA Section 4 test rule, because often the requirements are onerous, and the inferences that your chemical that you've been manufacturing for 50 years might have some developmental toxicity issues associated with it. So instead, the EPA has opted for other less confrontational mechanisms to get the data that it needs. But the great question in terms of, is it easy? It isn't that easy because of the legal burden the agency must satisfy in promulgating a TSCA Section 4 test rule. But once it is promulgated and it has withstood judicial review, then the parties are often more than happy to get together to share the cost. Now, the tricky part, too, is what about the offshore producer, the Indian or the Taiwanese or the Turkish or the Middle Eastern company that is not here in the United States but is a manufacturer? How likely is it that these offshore entities in all cases are going to, you know, come to the party when it comes to designing the protocol and collecting the monies to get the testing done? TSCA does have a data recovery or a cost reimbursement mechanism in it. But unlike FIFRA, which works really well, the TSCA cost reimbursement mechanism doesn't work so well. In fact, it's never, to my knowledge, been used. So if you have 80% of the community of the producers out there participating in the data production, getting the 20% that isn't in the party to cough up the goods is pretty darn hard. And the agency, not surprisingly, is disinclined and not resourced well to deploy limited agency resources to chase down the 20% deadbeats to get them to cough up their share of those data. It's just, that's life in the big city. It is what it is. So anyway, EPA has this authority to compel the production of data. It doesn't use it a lot. One of the concerns of TSCA reform, but again, this allows EPA to require the testing, and over the years there have been about 200 chemicals tested through the Section 4 program, which is a statistic that never fails to see the light of day in congressional hearings. Because isn't it true, Assistant Administrator so-and-so, that only 200 chemicals have gone through the program in the last 35 years? Yes. That's not a lot of chemicals. And so that's one of the concerns with it's a tough row and it's a steep legal burden to sustain a TSCA Section 4 rule, and there's got to be a better way. Oops. Getting back to our little paradigm here, EPA has all of this information gathering tools. It still has some issues, so it compels the Section 4 testing. Well, what if there are concerns after testing and information collection? Well, the TSCA Section 6 is the provision under TSCA that enables EPA to address unreasonable risks through restrictions, warning labels, record keeping, product bans, and other authorities under TSCA Section 6. Now, Section 6 is one of the most reviled, repudiated provisions under the statute because this is the TSCA provision that gave us the corrosion-proof fittings case, for example, where EPA tried to ban certain applications of asbestos, which is a well-recognized, icky chemical under certain circumstances, right? And in that lawsuit that was brought for EPA's failure, allegedly, to sustain its legal burden under the statute was affirmed. And so the rule was remanded back to EPA and came out a different critter. But the Section 6 authority is very sweeping. It gives EPA enormous authority to ban, diminish, label, or otherwise address a known, proven risk posed by a chemical in a workplace or other exposure scenario. But it's a tough legal standard, which is what the concern is all about and why some of the most of the provisions relating to tuss reform always address the Section 6 burden, that the burden on the agency is too high, the evidentiary standard is too great, and that's why so few chemicals have been effectively risk mitigated under TSCA Section 6. So what are some of the concerns with the current TSCA, the requirement? There's no requirement for data generation on new chemicals. If you have data, you got to submit it, but you're not compelled to produce that minimum data set. There's no minimum data set required for existing chemicals. Too few chemicals are tested under TSCA Section 4. 200 is not a lot in the universe of 85,000 to 90,000 chemicals. Not that they all need them, but statistically speaking, it's not a high number. Like the woman's reference with respect to CBI, big issue is manufacturers and those subject to TSCA have too cavalierly expressed confidential business information protection over information submitted to EPA. And I think that is true. But I think now there's people are much more mindful of the need to really assert CBI protection over a very narrow set of truly proprietary information to avoid assertions that too much information is being withheld from the public and in a way that might give rise to concerns about the underlying safety of a substance. So the overall critique is how many of the 85,000 to 90,000 chemicals in the inventory have been assessed for safety. And I think that's where the rubber hits the road, and that's why we see TSCA reform that has been on the books now for at least the last 5 years. But in the last couple years, we've really seen a very high number of hearings on chemical safety, minimum data set, data sharing, toxicological testing, and so on and so forth. But I'm just wondering if anything's going to happen this year. I wish it would. I'm not going to go through this. It's in your materials, which everyone has, right? But Senator Lautenberg has been a champion of TSCA reform for many years. She's tried valiantly to get both sides of the aisle to come together on meaningful TSCA reform that even the chemical community would recognize and agree needs to be revised. And the reason why the TSCA reform is so important, in my view, is not because I necessarily agree with all of these criticisms, but it doesn't matter. The debate is so much bigger than that. It's the American public no longer believes TSCA is a viable, effective statute for protecting exposures from chemicals. And so in order to recover the public's confidence and in order to remain competitive with the rest of the world with respect to the quality and granular level of chemical review and oversight, we need TSCA reform. And if you want to get down into even a tertiary level, in order to blunt the growing tidal wave of state-specific one-off chemical bans, we need a harmonized, effective federal chemical law. And we need it now. But I've put in here a number of core provisions in Senate 847, which is the current main event with respect to TSCA reform from Senator Lautenberger, that would explain, define chemical substance differently, and address many of, as I said, I'm not going to go through this because I'm running out of time, address many of the concerns that we have discussed with respect to the existing TSCA statute. I have a particular fondness with nanotechnology and nanoscale materials, and there are a number of very interesting developments which I will not go through here, but we will be shortly seeing a number of very interesting regulatory developments, which, again, for those of you that really enjoy the confluence of law, policy, innovative toxicological and technological innovations, nano is a wonderful area to be in. And what EPA has done in the new chemicals division and other offices, the Office of Research and Development, for example, is really take TSCA, take the best of TSCA and deploy it in a way, hey, Leslie, that enables the agency to get information that it desperately needs in order to assure the safety of these chemicals called nanoscale materials that in some instances are new and pose different novel risks, are commercially very beneficial, and have many very, very encouraging, promising commercial applications that will better all of us in many different applications, including site remediation, medicinal applications, just making products better, using less, product substitution, using smaller chemicals and less of them. So it's a great pollution prevention opportunity. But the agency is doing a terrific job of using its existing authorities in new and different ways. And for those of you that have any interest at all in the nano area, I'm happy to carry on in ridiculously nauseating detail, but not now. Okay, and a couple of other the recent developments. The agency has been very effective in using its TSCA Section 5A4 Chemicals of Concern Authority and has identified categories of chemicals, many of which you will recognize, benzidine dyes, bisphenol A, phthalates, long-chain perfluorinated chemicals, chemicals that are commonly used in my household over dinnertime conversations, sadly. But the agency is now identifying whole plans for addressing these concerns under existing TSCA authority. So it's a new, innovative way of using existing authority without having to go to TSCA reform. But lots of that on the EPA website for those of you so inclined to look. And I talked a little bit about IUR reporting. That rule should be out in final next month. Very important. And for those of you so inclined, be watching for that. Okay, let's turn quickly to my other favorite statute, the statute dealing with pesticides. FIFRA. Again, this is a federal program that, by and large, is not delegated to the states. And the offices are here in Washington. Actually, they're in Crystal City, over there at 1 Potomac Yard. And it's broken up into the Office of Pesticide Programs, dealing with different types of pesticides and different pieces of the pie. Scientists and health effects. Antimicrobial division, the antimicrobials that you have in a lot of embedded now in a lot of consumer products like triclosan, for example. So this is just an overview of the program implemented here in Washington and not by and large delegated to the states. Having said that, there are a number of states with very mature pesticide programs. California, not surprisingly, leading the pack. So when you get a pesticide and have it approved here at EPA, you can also expect to see substantive data production and other requirements in California, New York, and Florida. And pesticides are approved by EPA, but does that mean you get your ticket punched by the Office of Pesticide Programs and then you're good to go? No. Every state has its own state labeling law, but it's not a de novo review of the chemical as it might be under New York, California, and Florida. And in those jurisdictions, too, I don't want to mislead you. I don't want you to go back saying, oh, wow, you've got de novo review of a pesticide in these jurisdictions, because you don't. But California does have new data requirements over and above what might need to be satisfied by EPA. And New York and Florida could also as well, Florida being very concerned with citrus crop there and the very high water table and concerns with pesticide applications that could compromise the water quality. Okay. By and large, you know, once you do get your federal approval and then have your label approved at a state in which you intend to market your pesticide, you're good to go. And the state registration requirements are little more than revenue raising. They're annual requirements. So if you have a pesticide label on your product, you have to have it registered at EPA. And then you have this labeling requirement annually at the state level. And then you're pretty much ready to rock and roll. What is a pesticide? Well, it's any substance or mixture or substances intended, and the intent part is real important, for preventing, destroying, repelling, or mitigating any pest. So if you intend to use this chemical to do any of those things with regard to anything defined as a pest, you're in pesticide land. And that comes as a surprise to some people. It's very much an intent-based statute. So a substance is considered to be intended for pesticidal purposes and thus triggers FIFRA jurisdiction if the person who distributes or sells that substance implies that the substance can or should be used as a pesticide. So there's a whole bunch of case law about certain pool chemicals, for example, that you might not have necessarily intended your chemical to be used as a pesticide. It might be used for other aquatic purposes. But if you give rise to the implication that it has this pesticidal potency, you have triggered FIFRA jurisdiction, and the agency can nail you on distributing or marketing a pesticide without appropriate approvals. The core authority is under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, which was enacted years and years ago and has been partially implemented, too, in the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And there are a number of other statutes, the 1996 Food Quality Protection Act and the Pesticide Registration Improvement Act, that all are part of this universe of statutes. We're only going to focus on the core. The regulatory scope, you know, when you go to Home Depot and you look at a product and you see that it has EPA registration number and it's a pesticide, don't you usually see like active ingredient 0.03% and then a bunch of everything else, like the rest is 97.3 or whatever the percentage is. The active ingredient is the core active ingredient that is the subject of the EPA registration under FIFRA. And everything else are considered inert ingredients. And the inert is intended to connote that it is biologically benign and not potent, which may or may not be true, but it's the active ingredient that is the subject of the registration. But the formulation is that which is considered the pesticide product. You can have all types of different pesticide products, conventional products, so-called minimum risk products that are given a fast track through the registration process. Again, it's EPA's way of incentivizing chemicals that are believed to pose fewer risk. You have biopesticides, which are dealt with in one area of EPA, antimicrobials, and so-called treated articles. Like a treated article is an article that is treated with an antimicrobial. It might be a lunch bucket, that you're not making any claims with respect to the pesticidal properties of the lunch bucket, but you are taking the position that the inclusion of the antimicrobial in that product is protecting the article itself, and that article is not subject to registration as a pesticide. And there's a whole bunch of clients have gotten into trouble on this many, many times by making claims that go beyond the preservation and protection of the article itself. And we can carry on at some length about what those might include, but you've seen silver, for example, that like the airline silver cushions impregnated with silver. If they make claims that the pillow itself is going to protect you from germs, you've crossed the line. You can only say that the silver impregnated in the article, the silver being the antimicrobial and the pesticide ingredient, is preserving the article itself and is not bestowing a pesticidal or biological or antibacterial purpose beyond that cushion. Tricky stuff, big area of the law, a very interesting area, and probably beyond our scope here. Okay, core program, you know, I'm going to go very quickly through this because there are certain aspects of the FIFRA program that are more important than others, one of which goes to the registration of a new active ingredient. Remember we talked about new chemicals and whether or not they're on the inventory for purposes of industrial chemicals? Well, not unlike TSCA, if you have a new active ingredient, a brand new agricultural insecticide that's going to get rid of, say, the uber June bugs that have populated the fields of late. I don't know if you guys, we all go to the Eastern Shore every weekend and ride horses, and last weekend it was like a Stephen King movie because the June bugs are huge and a little bit probably resistant to more traditional insecticide applications, which you don't use a lot around equine applications anyway. But so let's say you've got a brand new product that is green and doesn't pose any biological risk to anything living except that June bug. And you've spent the last 10 years of your life developing the data to support this new active ingredient. The difference between FIFRA and TSCA is if you have a new active ingredient under FIFRA, you have a whole series of very rigorous, expensive testing requirements to demonstrate that active ingredient is safe and is not going to give rise to unreasonable adverse effects. Whereas under the TSCA program for the new chemical, you don't have that requirement with respect to minimum data set. So it's a big difference. And the other big difference between TSCA and FIFRA is under FIFRA, the type of data requirements that might apply with regard to your new active are specific to its application. FIFRA is very application-oriented. Once you get on the TSCA inventory, you're good. You can use that chemical any which way you want, and EPA doesn't have continuing jurisdiction over it for purposes of approval in a new market. Under FIFRA, every single application you intend to use, whether it's on a whole variety of raw agricultural chemicals, or it's if it's different use sites, crack and crevice, or closet space, in the house, out of the home, lawn and garden, every single one of those applications and uses is subject to EPA review, and it will dictate the level of data needed to support that use in a way that doesn't give rise to unreasonable adverse effects. Yes? I think if you think about the very good question was, what is the kind of underlying congressional rationale for requiring upfront chemical testing for a pesticide, whereas under the industrial chemical statute, there is no required upfront chemical testing or the demonstration of satisfaction of a minimum data set for an industrial chemical. And I think the whole goal behind a pesticide is to kill, repel, or mitigate. The reason that critter was created was to kill something or repel something. So I think there could have been some just rough thinking about, well, we better make pretty darn sure that when this chemical is used as intended, it is done so against a standard of safety that enables the reviewer, EPA or the state, to ensure that that chemical, that license to kill, as it were, is used in a way that is fully commensurate with known, identifiable, and mitigatable risks. So there's this big, important, and fundamental distinction in the conceptual framework between TSCA and FIFRA. And there's been an inclination, not surprisingly, particularly with the European chemical statute, to make TSCA look a whole lot more like FIFRA. And what are some of the big differences? Well, what we were talking about, 85, 90,000, there aren't that many chemicals in commerce. But even if there are 45, 50,000, there are far fewer chemicals regulated under FIFRA as active ingredients in order of magnitude. I don't, and I should know this, but I don't, and if anybody here does, feel free to, but there are far fewer industrial, or far more industrial chemicals regulated under TSCA than active ingredients regulated under FIFRA. But there is a certain appeal to making the conceptual constructs more symmetrical, and to make chemical industrial approval more commensurate with known uses, data sets that will address the identification of a core chemical profile. And then if you wish to engage in other applications under FIFRA, the entity comes into EPA, and we prepare registration amendments that say we would now like this chemical to be used in this new use site, against this new crop, against this new vector, or in this new application. And here are the data that support our demonstration that it doesn't pose an unreasonable risk in this section or under these application scenarios. So very different intellectual constructs, which is why TSCA has been the subject of a pretty ferocious criticism when you have a different regulatory construct that is chemical-specific, application-specific, upfront chemical testing, and rigorous re-review at prescribed intervals under the re-registration standard to ensure that that chemical continues to be safe after it's been approved. There's no continuing. Once you're on that TSCA inventory, you know, you're done until EPA exercises its Section 4 authority based on newer risks, based on more recent concerns with the chemical. So pre-market approval, you bet. You get a new active or a new use of an existing active ingredient. You have a lot of hoops to jump through and a lot of data requirements. and you have to show that there is no unreasonable risk for non-food uses and a reasonable certainty of no harm, a standard that has more recently been bandied about in the TSCA context for food uses. And these are very well-crafted terms of art that have a lot of gloss and patina and legal wrappings around them, which we're not going to go through here because it would take way too long. But that is the safety standard for purposes of food and non-food uses. And that reasonable certainty of no harm is thought to be the most, you know, strenuous safety standard under these regulatory constructs. And the burden is very clearly on the registrant. See, under FIFRA, the registrant must show that its active ingredient in any formulations thereof for any uses it wishes to market and have on its label poses no unreasonable risk for a non-food use of wood preservative, for example, or a reasonable certainty of no harm for a chemical that might be applied to raw agricultural products or in processed foods. No question, the registrant has to show that. Under TSCA, the burden is on EPA to show that the chemical poses an unreasonable risk. So there's that shifting of the burden, which again has been the subject of innumerable arguments and rhetoric and law review articles. And why is that? And the analysis between TSCA and FIFRA is a very interesting exercise because they're so different in many core respects, but the who has the burden, what is it, is a pretty critical one between TSCA and FIFRA. EPA reviews all of the information against these standards. The testing is aggressive, very, very aggressive. You have to be looking at millions for a pretty standard chemical in a more conventional context. You're looking at millions of dollars of data. For some of the new biopesticides that are less aggressive and have lower risk thresholds in terms of their toxicological profile, less so. But I can't tell you how many people will call up on our 800 line and say, I've got brand new chemical. I want to get registered under FIFRA. I want to do it by the end of the year, and I've got $12.85 to devote to it. And after 15 minutes of that conversation, it's like, dude, no. The average registration cost is several million dollars for a conventional agrochemical. Some of these others, you know, maybe hundreds of thousands, but definitely more than usually a five-digit number. And then you've got the whole do the testing part and getting your submission ready. So it's not for the weak need. You really need to want to get into this market, and you really need to have the determination to do the data and do it right, because a lot of people think they're going to parachute into the FIFRA market and make a killing, and it just doesn't work that way. It's a very well-run, disciplined, labor-intensive, data-intensive program. There are lots of protections for proprietary information and trade secrets under FIFRA. It's a very competitive area. EPA has adopted in the more recent past a narrowing of those protections, and we'll talk a little bit about that time permitting, where each EPA has made the process for new chemical approval more transparent. There are now notices in the Federal Register, for example, if you have a new active, whereas before they didn't, in all cases, were not noted, and there are broader stakeholders of populations that are now invited to participate in meetings with the agency, whereas before they were just the registrant and invited others and EPA. There is a very important data compensation provision for third-party use of data. Remember I talked about EPA issues a data call-in for phenol under the TSCA program, and all the domestic producers get together and share in the cost of data. What about the folks that sit on the sidelines and don't participate? TSCA does not have a good mechanism to allow the people that have ponied up to seek a cost reimbursement action against the people who are sitting on the sidelines not doing the work. FIFRA, on the other hand, has a very good program that enables so-called follow-on registrants to cite these multi-million-dollar data packages. You submit a form agreeing to pay compensation to the entities that own the data, which is an intellectual asset under FIFRA, and the parties are given an opportunity in a commercial setting to negotiate what the cost of that reliance on those data are. So the good news is the data owner is compensated for its financial investment in procuring and developing a new market, but the follow-on registrant, who is just a new, say it's a chemical company, has no interest whatever in developing the molecule, but wants to have the right to get a source of that data or that chemical and rely on the data generated by the original registrant. So that is very much a part of the FIFRA program. It encourages competition. It encourages multiple use of data. It diminishes animal testing. And it allows competitors to negotiate the cost of relying on that very expensive data package. And there are law firms in town that work, as I'm sure you folks do, on these so-called data compensation arbitrations. Because what if I'm the data owner, and I say, sure, you can rely upon my data. I want $50 billion. Thank you very much. Pay here. And the follow-on registrant said, but, well, wait a minute. We were prepared to offer $50,000. Parties are very far apart. You have a limited period of time to negotiate an opportunity to resolve that commercial challenge. And then after that, either party can elect to participate in what is called a AAA, American Arbitration Association, data compensation arbitration. And it is in that venue that the parties present information in an evidentiary hearing that looks a whole lot like a trial as to what the value of those data are. What is the cost of reproducing those data? What is the cost of the early market entry? What is the cost of the risk the original registrant has borne to develop that market? It's a fascinating area of the law for those of you that, you know, like the business side and like quantifying data and like these administrative opportunities to tell a third tri-person panel what the data are worth and how much a market might be valued at. So there's a good deal of economics, business, and science in data compensation arbitrations. And it's a very well-oiled machine under FIFRA, because the people who are sophisticated players try desperately to avoid data compensation arbitrations. They're very expensive propositions. Any questions on that? Okay. This is, I just wanted to throw in here what a kind of a typical pesticide label looks like. This artwork you see, this is not random. This is a very prescriptive business. The agency signs off on every single word in that label. And in the more recent past, EPA and stakeholders and responsible product steward-minded registrants want these labels to be as informative and as read and easily understood as humanly possible for all the reasons you might imagine. So there's a good deal of work that goes into the crafting of this artwork. But there are mandatory label requirements, the placement, the size of the lettering, what can go on, what can't go on. Very, very prescriptive. And negotiating the terms of these labels in and of itself often gives rise to competitive issues, because older labels, for example, that are been on the books for a long time might not have all the new bells and whistles of a brand new entrant in the same market. And then you get the whole, but well, wait a minute, their label doesn't say all that icky stuff about risk and harm. So there are a lot of competitive issues in the pesticide area, in large part simply because the nature of the program is such that newer entrants into the market with either new uses of existing products or new products altogether that compete with some of the older legacy molecules often are subject to what some might argue is more onerous regulation, thus limiting their commercial opportunities, thus giving rise to anti-competitive and competitive issues that are the subject that lawsuits are made of. New actives, products, uses. Before the Product Pesticide Registration Improvement Act, a law that came into effect not so very long ago, it was never clear when you submitted a pesticide registration application, either for a new active or a new use on an existing active, when it was going to be processed. And for business people, you can imagine lining up your dealers and distributors, your artwork, your business community is tough when you don't know what the end game is. So the Pesticide Registration Improvement Act was created in order to provide a level of business certainty as to how long a particular application, pre-market or existing market approval, would take. So it's been a really useful statute. It's up for amendment and reauthorization again this year. And it provides these buckets of time frames. So if you've got a brand new active ingredient and you fall into the biopesticide category and you don't have these types of uses, you're looking at 6 to 9 months or 18 to 24 months. So that element of business certainty is great. The other element is it provides a continuing opportunity for EPA to assess fees for the preparation and its review of these chemical applications. And they're not insubstantial. I mean, a new pesticide, conventional insecticide or fungicide might well be, you know, a six-digit number. These are not trivial fees, which is the other reason often why I'm having these casual conversations with people that have no clue about the pesticide community. And I say, you know, the application itself is $75,000. You either hear a big sigh or a click, because people don't appreciate that it's a little bit of a pay-to-play at EPA for pesticide applications. You really are a participant in the fee process with the agency. As I said, there are opportunities for having a more accelerated approval process. This is the agency's way of incentivizing the development of greener, less toxic chemicals, reduced fees, expedited reviews, dedicated resources. What's not to like? So there is an inherent incentive to be developing these greener molecules, and they are of enormous interest to, you know, innovators in the community and to EPA for all the reasons you might imagine. What are the opportunities for EPA to swoop in there when all is not well on the horizon? The agency has a whole complement of enforcement authorities. It can restrict chemicals that are thought to be non-compliant with either your confidential statement of formula, which is the confidential information regarding the precise formula of your chemical. And if what you are actually manufacturing is not strictly consistent with what you claim it is, you're marketing chemical that is not registered under FIFRA, and the agency has the authority to stop the sale of that, impose horrific civil penalties, criminal penalties if it was knowing and willful. Lots of opportunities for EPA to address instances of noncompliance with FIFRA. The tricky part is it's very difficult, absent actual knowledge, that a chemical that is being formulated does not comply with its super secret confidential statement of formula. You might have, you know, upper and lower confidence levels that get out of whack because the manufacturing process was subject to an upset or some intervening event. And being, how is anyone to know that, either from the producer community or EPA? So enforcement is not as robust under FIFRA as it is under TASA. You don't see these eye-popping, heroic penalties that you do under TSCA, that under FIFRA at all. That's probably changing a little bit. EPA is being far more aggressive on misbranding claims these days, taking the position that chemicals that are being marketed in a way that go beyond their approved label claims are misbranded and give rise to substantial penalties. We're involved in a number of those now, and we're looking at multi-million-dollar penalties. If you have radio ads, for example, that state things pertinent to claims made on your pesticide that go beyond what EPA believes your label allows. Those are fish in a barrel opportunities, and don't get into the more difficult, granular, how do you prove that what is being marketed is not strictly compliant with the terms and provisions of a confidential statement of formula. What are some recent developments? Not unlike what we talked about under TSCA, we're looking at increased transparency. Starting just in the last fiscal year, EPA risk assessments and proposed decisions for new pesticide active ingredients and subset of certain new uses are now published in a public docket. And, you know, the agricultural community wasn't especially appreciative of that because it is amenable, that this is a process that is amenable to competitive abuse. You can have people that will start throwing stones at a new use or a new active, not because of health or risk issues, but because of competitive concerns. So I think that process is still working its way out, but it is the agency's way of bringing more transparency to this review process. Lots going on in nanoscale ingredients. EPA takes the position, and I think correctly so, that a nanoscale version, a very teeny tiny version of an already approved existing active ingredient, is itself a new pesticide. That's completely the opposite under TSCA, another important big picture difference between TSCA and FIFRA. Because EPA takes a position under TSCA that if you have a nanoscale version of an industrial chemical that is listed on the inventory, it is presumptively existing. OPP takes a position that if you have a teeny tiny version of a conventional active ingredient, it's new. And so you have to go in the front door and get it re-approved by EPA as a new active ingredient. That's not yet been much the subject of a lot of debate. There is one nano-silver application that EPA has preliminarily proposed to approve as the first nano-active, the so-called high-Q application. EPA approved it. Or has proposed to approve, a lot of public comment on it, and approved it, number one, conditionally and subject to a four-year time-limited approval and a lot of data production requirements. So that's what's going on in the area of antimicrobial nanopesticides. The very recent and very interesting policy development that EPA issued just this past June, a little less than a month ago, is EPA's suggestion that if you have or you know that your active ingredient, your pesticide formulation, contains any element of a nanoscale component to it, whether active or inert, it gives rise to a reporting obligation under the FIFRA Section 6A2 provision, which is the functional equivalent of the TSCA 8E adverse effects notification. Remember we talked about the adverse effects. If you have a chemical and you come to know that that chemical is posing a new toxicological or environmental risk and you didn't know it before, you have 30 days to report it to EPA. Well, there's a very parallel provision under FIFRA called FIFRA Section 6A2, which if you have an existing pesticide formulation and you get new information that it's posing an adverse effect, you have an immediate reporting obligation as that term is defined under FIFRA. And EPA proposed on June 17th to make information regarding the presence of a nanoscale component of an existing active ingredient or formulated product subject to 6A2 reporting if you know you've got a small, any component of a nanoscale material in your pesticide formulation, a position that we vigorously oppose, simply because we believe it will demonize nanomaterials in a way that will not give rise to the commercialization of the technology. And there are better ways of getting that information. And to its credit, EPA proposed, as an alternative, information that would be reportable under its 3C2B authority, which is the authority EPA has under FIFRA that enables it to issue a data call-in for existing active ingredients, not unlike the FIFRA Section 4 provision. So there's a good deal of symmetry in certain functionalities with respect to agrochemicals and industrial chemicals, but in certain core provisions, many of which we've identified over the last, what seems to you all like interminable length of time, are pretty fundamentally different. And in this instance, this 3C2B and TSCA Section 4 are parallel in that the agency is empowered to seek new information. And our suggestion was, working with the agrochemical community, is EPA wants information. It has the authority under FIFRA Section 3C2B to request it, and do it that way. Don't presume or give rise to the inference that any component, any aspect of a nanoscale material in an existing pesticide formulation is presumptively adverse, which is kind of the translation with the 6A2 adverse effects notification. So comment on that just today was extended to August 17th, so I know you're going to want to submit comment, wanting the 3C2B authority over the 6A2, but comment is now due in mid-August. Another very important and very interesting case is the misbranding, the Reckitt-Benckiser decision, which came out earlier this year. And very quickly, there is a concern that under FIFRA, if EPA wishes to stop the registration of a chemical, it has to begin a cancellation proceeding. And a cancellation proceeding, as you might imagine, is a very big deal. It is a long adjudication that is de novo. It requires a lot of evidentiary showing that the chemical is giving rise to unreasonable adverse effects. It's a protracted, expensive process, both for EPA and the registrant. So what EPA did in Reckitt-Benckiser, rather than initiate a cancellation proceeding with respect to a particular rodenticide, EPA said that if you didn't label the product in a way that reflected its view, the product, if marketed, would be per se misbranded. And the registrant took the position, well, golly, that sounds an awful lot like a cancellation, because if it's misbranded, I can't market the product, or if I do, I do so at considerable cost and penalty, and if I do so intentionally, that gives rise to all kinds of inferences. So Reckitt-Benckiser took EPA to court, and the court agreed. They said, you know, EPA, if you want to cancel a pesticide, you got to cancel a pesticide. You can't say you're misbranding by not following our instructions. So that's an interesting decision that came out earlier this year, and we've been monitoring it closely because there are other regulatory developments consistent with that. But I know this has been a very whirlwind tour of two very, very, very interesting related but separate statutes. I will make this offer now. You have my email. You have my phone number. If anybody has any questions about anything certainly pertinent to this discussion, give me a call or shoot me an email. I'm happy, happy, happy to mentor, share information, or clarify. I do an awful lot of that because I love this area of the law, and I'm trying to bring newer, younger, smarter practitioners to the table. But any questions before we wind up? Oh, just so many. Yes.
Yeah, okay, fine. You know, they kill people in very, very tiny amounts. Mm-hmm. They're known or strongly suspected for some reason. People in the chemistry community aren't using those things just because they're there. They're really, you know, they're using them both industrially and in a research sense because there really isn't anything that does that. You know, the search for the alternative is not something that kind of academic. I mean, it's really done from a life safety perspective, mm-hmm. both in a laboratory and industrial sense. Mm-hmm. And I think what's always a little bit of a mystery is, I think from the perspective of the chemistry community, where the rubber kind of hits the road on a lot of this, it's not sort of a yes, no, what are you using, but how are you using it, the amount, are you using it in sort of a sealed recapture?
Right.
Kind of, it's the process end.
Right.
There really is only one chemical, or the chemical that they're using to do that
mm-hmm.
is already an alternative for something that's even worse, that you just wouldn't even consider using. So the emphasis in TSCA, particularly on this sort of yes-no dynamic that I think you alluded to, is that I am not familiar with some of the reform proposals. I mean, it's sort of moving away from that kind of framework to something that is more sensitive to the, not just the use it or not use it, but the how part of what they're going for?
Sure. I mean, I'm not That was a very thoughtful question, and you inspire about 47 different issues there. But for those on the phone, I mean, the question is whether some of the TSCA reform initiatives are mindful of the need to kind of distance ourselves from legacy chemicals that might really be amenable to product substitution or deselection, or is it really a desire in that venue and in green chemistry generally to instill a sense of stewardship and diminished use and safer, more protective uses of existing chemicals that perhaps have no alternatives? And it is true that there are certain chemicals with certain functionalities for which safer alternatives may not exist. But I think some of the, certainly the Green Chemistry Initiative in California, under California law, and I think much of what Senator Lautenberg and his colleagues are hoping to do under TSCA is address some of the more fundamental data deficits with respect to existing chemicals. I mean, they shouldn't presume to be safe as they might be now because they have been grandfathered. If chemicals are safe and you have a minimum data set or you can demonstrate through other scientifically defensible means that it poses no risk, that's good. It doesn't mean you deselect the chemical because it's a chemical. It means that you have met a standard of safety and care that is defensible and gives the public a sense of well-being and comfort that it deserves. I think the move to greener pastures is also driven by the desire for chemical manufacturers to be more efficient, to have diminished uses and exposures just generally to worker populations, to distributors, to downstream users, and other life cycle. We didn't even get into life cycle discussions. Like when a chemical has fulfilled its intended commercial use, what happens to it? At the front end of the process, manufacturers should be designing their line so that when a article is no longer useful for its intended purpose, its end life doesn't itself give rise to risks that will cause concerns down the road. And so some of the legislative opportunities and the focus on redoing things smarter, better, faster, greener, cheaper are all driven by a different mindset of going from the beginning of the product to the end of the product and being mindful of its opportunities for intervention, exposure, and chemical and human degradation and harm at every step of the way. So if that, the sensitivity toward diminished use is, it's much more complicated than that's bad, get rid of it, this is good, keep up with it. It's always looking for opportunities at every stage of the product life cycle, manufacture, use, and disposal, for doing things better, smarter, in a more protective, more product stewardship, more protective way. You know, there's nothing inherently bad about chemicals. Everything in the world is chemical. We are chemicals. It's how we perceive them, how we justify their use, and on what level of science and integrity do we ensure that the sustainable use of these chemicals is just that. And that's what I think a lot of what the legislative initiatives are all about right now, but not just deselecting everything, because there are an awful lot of chemicals for which there are no viable alternatives. But if there are viable alternatives, a lot of the legislative initiatives provide some very compelling incentives to get into those markets, develop those markets, and just make the world a better place. We didn't even talk about exclusive use periods under FIFRA. If you develop a brand new molecule, you are guaranteed under FIFRA 10 years of exclusive use. That means no one else can get into your market, unless you ask them to, for 10 years. That is your guaranteed monopoly on a market. That's a very compelling incentive to get in there and do things differently and be new. And there are similar incentives, although less so under TSCA, I think. So I know that's a long response to a very good question that goes far beyond what we're able to do here, but it's a complicated area. And for those of you, they'll end with where we began, wishing to pursue a intellectually stimulating, scientifically rigorous, and fascinating from a policy perspective area of the law, product regulation is where you want to be. So I guess I will end. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for letting me be here, Rebecca, and hope you have liked it.